From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Sex and the City, we meet Darren Star, the creator of the HBO comedy series about four single women and their misadventures searching for good sex and the right man. The new season begins Sunday. Star also created Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place. This Sunday at the Tony Awards ceremony, music director Paul Gemignani will receive a Lifetime Achievement Award. We'll talk with him about working on most of Stephen Sondheim's musicals. He's currently with the revival of Kiss Me, Kate. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Survivor, the new CD by Destiny's Child. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A lawyer for Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh said today that he expects McVeigh will agree tomorrow to file a request to block his execution. Attorney General John Ashcroft pledged to fight any further delay in the execution, saying it would deny justice for the victims of the bombing and for the American people. Ashcroft himself postponed the execution to June 11th after the FBI disclosed that it had failed to turn over thousands of documents related to the investigation of the bombing. Ashcroft and the FBI have insisted that nothing in the documents contradicts McVeigh's conviction or his later admission that he committed the bombing that killed 168 people. U.S. forces in the Gulf state of Bahrain are on high alert in response to a security threat. Bahrain is the headquarters of the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
A Pentagon official says U.S. forces there earlier this week were put on Threat Condition Charlie, which is the second highest state of alert. According to Pentagon guidelines, ThreatCon Charlie indicates that intelligence has been received indicating that some form of terrorist action may be imminent. A senior Pentagon official says the alert was based on a threat to a specific area. He would not elaborate. The official says the Bahrain threat came before the announcement of a guilty verdict in the New York trial of four men in the 1998 embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. This is a different threat, the official said. U.S. forces in Bahrain were put on the very highest alert in the aftermath of the attack on the USS Cole last October. As the Fifth Fleet headquarters, Bahrain is considered a likely terrorist target in the Gulf region. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill said today that he's looking for ways to get refund checks mandated by the new tax bill into the hands of taxpayers before September. NPR's John Idstey reports.
Speaking to reporters at the Treasury, O'Neill said he'd like to speed up the distribution of the refund checks, but he said he's not sure that can happen. The $1.35 trillion tax bill approved by Congress this past weekend calls for tax rebates this year of up to $300 for unmarried singles, $500 for single parents, and $600 for married couples filing joint returns. Even before the bill passed, the Treasury was preparing for the possibility of a rebate, including ordering the paper needed for the estimated 95 million checks that will be mailed to taxpayers. The administration wants to get the checks into consumers' hands as quickly as possible to stimulate the sagging economy. O'Neill said the rebates should boost growth this year by about a half a percentage point. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 166 points, or 1.5%, to close at 10,872 in active trading. The Nasdaq lost 91 points. This is NPR News. Germany's parliament has voted to clear the way for payments to more than a million people who were forced into slave labor during the Nazi regime. The payments will come from a $4.6 billion compensation fund created by the government and German businesses that allegedly benefited from slave labor. Former slave laborers are expected to receive one-time payments of up to $6,700 each. In separate incidents, gunmen in Mexico City have assassinated a former police chief and his two brothers. Another group attempted to kidnap the wife of the capital's attorney general. James Bleers has more.
Former Mexico City judicial police chief Jesus Ignacio Corolla was shot six times in the face at point-blank range. His two brothers, who were in the same car, were also shot dead. In a separate incident, the wife of Mexico City's attorney general Bernardo Batis narrowly escaped a kidnap attempt when her vehicle was peppered with 11 bullets. Three men have been arrested and one bodyguard has been hospitalized with a chest wound. The U.S. Embassy in Mexico City has repeatedly warned about the dangers of the capital streets. For NPR News, I'm James Blears in Mexico City.
NASA has postponed the launch of the space shuttle that was scheduled to deliver a new crew to the International Space Station. Mission managers say they want to investigate computer problems with the station's new robot arm before sending the space shuttle Atlantis. That means the Atlantis launch will be delayed from a date in June until sometime in early July. The delay means that the current space station crew, two Americans and a Russian, will spend a few extra weeks in space. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
So what have you been doing lately?
You mean besides going out every night?
Yeah, I mean, what do you do for work?
Well, this is my work. I'm sort of a sexual anthropologist.
You mean like a hooker?
No. I write a column called Sex and City. Right now I'm researching an article about women who have sex like men. You know, they have sex, and then afterwards they feel nothing.
That's Sarah Jessica Parker and Chris Noth in the first episode of Sex and the City, an HBO comedy about four single women in their 30s and their misadventures searching for good sex and lasting relationships. The show's fourth season begins this Sunday on HBO. My guest Darren Star created the series and has written many of the episodes. Star also created Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place. Last season, he had two new shows that were canceled, The Street, about young stockbrokers, and Gross Point, a backstage comedy about the making of a series just like 90210. Here's a scene from this Sunday's season premiere of Sex and the City. Sex columnist Carrie Bradshaw is at a coffee shop with her three best friends, talking about an unsolicited dating service application that she's just received in the mail. Her friend Miranda reads it.
Dear Single. Single? You don't even have a name?
Well, I'm single. I don't deserve one.
Oh. That's the postal equivalent of a drive-by shooting.
Yeah, and I thought those 57 menus I get every day from Hunan Munan were annoying.
Mm. Look at this. Don't let your soulmate slip away.
Oh, I know. It's almost a threat. It's like, we have him. He's just waiting for you, but hurry, because he's slipping away. Oops, there he goes.
Soulmates only exist in the Hallmark aisle in Duane Reade Drugs.
I disagree. I believe that there's that one perfect person out there to complete you.
And if you don't find him, what? You're incomplete? It's so dangerous.
All right, first of all, the idea that there's only one out there, I mean, why don't I just shoot myself right now? I'd like to think that people have more than one soulmate.
I agree. I've had hundreds.
Yeah, and you know what? If you miss one, along comes another, like cats.
No, that is not how it works.
Oh, okay.
But you're still looking outside yourself. It's saying that you're not enough.
Are you enough?
Actually, today she's too much.
Darren Star told me why he wanted to create a series about single women and their relationships.
Men and women have a lot of equality right now, and I think that equality is in the workplace to a degree. But I think when you get it out into the relationship world, it's you're dealing with the same old traditional stuff, and I think that's where it gets messy. Is when women are supposedly on equal footing with men at work, but then they have to follow the old rules in relationships, and I think that's. That's sort of what makes the dilemmas that these women face in Sex and the City kind of, different than a similar show would have been, a generation ago. Because, women are told that they're equal to men in the workplace. And yet, romantically, I think that, the same old rules of courtship are followed between men and women. And I think it's difficult sometimes for women to have to deal with to have a lot of control at work and a lack of control in their personal lives. And I think it's sometimes difficult for men to, to suddenly confront, women who aren't following the traditional roles of their moms.
Did you have any reservations about writing a series about sex from a woman's point of view while being a man?
I didn't, because I kind of feel that some of the women that I hang around with, but they're very open and honest, especially when they get into their 30s. It's sort of like they talk about sex and they talk about their lives in a very frank and honest way. That as a writer, is really appealing because men, I think, are a little bit more closed off emotionally, especially as they get older. And I think women are very open, and I think that they are more, they're just more communicative about what's going on. And I felt that the fallacy is that, you know, that men, this sort of locker room talk about, you know, around, you know, with guys, is that guys are talking about women in graphic detail, when I think the truth is a little bit more that women are talking about men in just as graphic detail. And I think that's something that hadn't been kind of like, the lid hadn't been pulled off of that. But I think as a writer, you know, you can write from a female point of view and not be a woman. You can have a lot of understanding and objectivity. The thing that's always surprising to me is, well, why didn't a woman create this show? You know, and I think sometimes when you're so close to a subject matter, maybe you don't have the perspective, or you don't see the comic possibilities, which is another thing that I certainly, you know, objectively saw the dilemma that a lot of my single female friends were in, and, you know, thought it was a lot of things, tragic, frustrating, and funny.
Tell me a good story that came from one of your friends' lives that you ended up using in the show.
Oh, gosh. You know, everything comes from... all these stories that are on the show come from some bit of reality. I mean, by the way, the show's just not written by myself or just by men. There are women on the staff as well. And sometimes, you know, I'll hear something or... you know, a story, for instance, that somebody said, well, that we actually used in an episode where, you know, it was, again, one of these, maybe it's an urban myth or a friend of a friend story, but that a friend of a friend had her diaphragm stuck and couldn't get it out after sex. And that she actually had to have her friend help her get it out. Now, I thought that story was the most outrageous, unbelievable thing I'd ever heard. And I thought it couldn't possibly be true. But then talking to some women on the staff, they actually confirm, yes, it happens. Diaphragms get stuck. And yes, a very, very, very good friend might be compelled to help you pull it out. And the way we used that was Carrie was was sleeping with Mr. Big, which is sort of her, you know, her...
her idea of a perfect catch, except that he's been married.
Her bête noire of relationships. Yeah, right. You know, it's like the guy that she thinks is the perfect guy, but never really is. He's the elusive He's the elusive male, okay, in her life. And she wanted friends to know that she was sleeping with him, but then she ended up having, needing one of them to help her with her diaphragm. And, of course, then the question is, well, what was it doing there in the first place? So, I mean, that's a kind of story that, as a man, I would think, I didn't believe it. And... maybe some of the listeners out there still don't believe it, but I'm assured that it's in the realm of possibility. And I think another thing to remember about this show is that it's a comedy. And in a wonderful way, the audience, especially women, relate to the independence of these women to the point where, you know, there's a lot of identification going on. We are writing a comedy. And we're not looking, it's not a documentary of single life in New York. It's a comedy that's meant to also to entertain.
It's funny, writing a series like this must give you the ability to just talk about women really openly about their sex lives. And I bet a lot of women are enthusiastic about talking to you about their sex lives, knowing that you're writing the series.
I think it's open lines of communication that I never imagined. I mean, I grew up in a household where we really didn't talk about sex that much. You know, it was sort of like an off-limits subject. It just was never really spoken about. And I think that a lot of people were raised that way. And I think there's a tremendous freedom that people have when they sense that they can talk about sex openly. And I think that it sort of opened a lot of floodgates. I think this show has opened lines of communication in a big way, especially when, you know, between men and women, when they can just, they have a touchstone, they have a way to talk about sex now if people have seen the show.
What kind of boundaries do you work with in terms of the language you can use on HBO when you're writing Sex and the City and what you can show?
Our boundaries are basically our own good taste, which I think a lot of people would think isn't all that great. But they're pretty open at HBO in terms of, I think, as long as something is, you know, serving the story and isn't just sensationalistic for the sake of being sensationalistic. I mean, I think they let us do what we want.
Define your own good taste. What are the limits of your own good taste?
What are the limits of my own good
taste? Yeah, I mean, what do you think goes beyond the boundaries of your good taste? Things that you've decided, well, we won't use that word, or we won't show that.
I think everything has to have, you know, a comic effect, and I think that's what, you know, that's what it comes down to. And I think the show from the beginning was meant to be a little bit shocking, and I think that, you know, the trouble, you know, one gets into doing a show like this is you feel there's that sense that, oh, you always got to top yourself. And I think that's when you run the risk of heading into bad taste if you think that way. You know, if you think, wow, well, now we got to just do something shocking because people are expecting something shocking. But I think that we're all sort of more guided by our sense of comedy, which comedy's not always in good taste. A lot of comedy, you can't worry about good taste when you're thinking about writing comedy. Every once in a while, you're going to cross the line.
There was an episode last season in which, Miranda was involved with a steady boyfriend, and it was something very unusual for her. This was a relationship that didn't have the incredible highs of a new romance. It had settled into a very intimate relationship in which she would do his laundry Saturday nights, and she mm-hmm. told her girlfriend she really liked staying home and doing his laundry Saturday nights, until she found something really startling in her boyfriend's laundry bag. Let me play that scene.
I was wrong. There is a point at which a couple can get too comfortable, and I think I reached it this morning washing Steve's underwear.
Why? What happens?
I'm living with skid marks, Guy.
Oh, no. Oh, terrible.
I don't get it. Why do men get skid marks? Is it laziness? Or are they just in a rush?
I don't know, but whatever it is, it goes hand in hand with urinating on the seat.
I tell you one thing, when your boyfriend is so comfortable he can't be bothered to wipe his ass.
Oh, God!
That's the end of romance, right there.
Well, it's certainly the end of laundry night.
It got me thinking. Maybe I'm mistaking falling into a rut with intimacy.
How often are you guys having sex?
Often enough, but it's totally generic. We've got every move down pat. It's more like a race to have an orgasm than anything else.
Still, it's nice to be a contestant, isn't it?
Sure, I know what you mean. We whine when we don't have a boyfriend, and we whine when we do.
That was Sarah Jessica Parker and Cynthia Nixon in a scene from Sex and the City. My guest, Darren Star, wrote that episode. I'm wondering if skid marks was your original expression, or if that's an expression that's already in the language.
I don't think I coined skid marks.
No, okay.
I think I've heard that one before. You're really hitting my finest moment, I have to say.
And what made you think of using that as a subplot?
Well, I think that it's certainly like the antithesis to what everyone's, you know, idealization of a relationship is. I mean, there's it's the notion that when you are actually in a relationship and living with somebody, you know, the reality is often very prosaic. And I think that that's certainly a prime example of Miranda's in love with the romanticism of doing her boyfriend's laundry and being with her boyfriend 24 hours a day, and they're this intimate couple. And I think that, it's coming up on the reality of two people living together. Sometimes that's what it's about, skid marks.
You actually show the stained underwear in this episode. Did you debate whether or not to actually put that on camera or not?
I think there was a moment of thinking, do we want to do this? But I think ultimately that is the gag, you know, that, and so in the edit, you know, I spend time with every episode in the editing room, and I look at it and think, well, is this funny or is it not funny? And I think, again, it did talk, you know, we're talking about the boundaries of good taste. And I think that if it gets a laugh, it stays in. If it just gets a big gross, I don't want to see that. It's out.
What kind of response did you get to that episode?
I think, again, it's one of these areas that's a little that is a little taboo. Once people say, "Oh yeah, skid marks," people then can laugh about it. And I think also, it's about it. It's a guy thing. You know, I think it's just sort of like it's an unconscious guy thing. It's something that I would never attribute to a woman. Ever, but for some reason, you know, it's like a, It's a silly juvenile guy thing.
My guest is Darren Star, creator of the HBO series Sex and the City. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Darren Star is my guest. He's the creator of Sex and the City, which just started its fourth season on HBO. And he also created Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place. Now, you had two new series that were on this past season, and both of them ended up concluding pretty quickly. Canceled is the word, yeah. One was called The Street, and it was a series about people who work on Wall Street. And the other was called Grosse Pointe. And it was like a behind-the-scenes parody of the making of a series very much like Beverly Hills 90210, except the dramas here were happening behind the scenes, what the actors were doing behind the scenes in their romances and their eating disorders and their dishing of each other and so on. Was it kind of gruesome for you to have two series canceled in one season?
Well, they didn't both get canceled on the same day.
Well, that's good.
That was good.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it was the hardest part of doing a series is the first season. So in a sense, you feel that by the time you've done the pilot and by the time you've gotten through most of the first year, you know, you've learned so much, a lot of hard work in so many different areas is done. So, yes, it was a lot of hard work. And I think two good shows that it's disappointing. There's no other word.
Your series Grosse Pointe was a parody of Beverly Hills 90210, and the characters off screen were incredibly obnoxious to each other. Plus, there were romances off screen and eating disorders and so on. Was it like that when you were making Beverly Hills 90210? That there was more stuff going on behind the scenes than there even was in the series itself?
Well, I think all shows. There's just a great history of backstage drama. And I always thought that, Grosse Pointe in essence was a show about a high class trailer park, because that's where most actors spend their time between scenes and their trailers. And they hang out in their trailers, and then they have, they've got a lot of time to to turn a million thoughts over in their head and kind of, create trouble. So I still think that it's a great workplace comedy. Shows that I've had that have become hits have never become hits in their first season. For whatever reason, 90210, Melrose Place, and Sex and the City all became hits in their second season. And they all followed an interesting pattern that Grosse Pointe was following, which was they started to have this sort of like proprietary viewership that was very passionate about the show. And, going on the internet and looking at the fans that watch Grosse Pointe, and people that I'd meet on the street, they were very passionate about it. They felt that they'd discovered a show that was their show. And I think that show had a lot of life, and the seed had just been planted. So it's a disappointment in that sense, because I think that it still had a huge amount of potential.
What's one of the best things you learned from working with Aaron Spelling?
One thing was an incredible sense of perseverance. The guy, he never says die. He's always, with 90210, that show was, it's hard to imagine, but it was hanging on by a thread the first season. And we were getting, from the network orders in we had our initial order of 12 episodes, and then it would be like, well, okay, another two, and then another three. And he had a lot of passion. He really believed in the show, and he was a tremendous advocate at the network for keeping it going, where I think a lot of producers would say, well, it's look at the ratings, it's not working. And that's a lesson that I learned, which is you can't, for the first season of a show, I don't think I've ever done a show that was a lower rated show than 90210 in its first season. So it taught me that you can't look at the world in terms of what the ratings are. You've got to look at your own show and say, wow, is this a show that I you know, believe in and have a lot of passion for, and you know, you've got to fight for that. And that was a good lesson, and I think that it, you want to align yourself with people like that, who, as a writer and producer, you want to align yourself with, studio heads that are going to do that for you.
A lot of articles about you have mentioned that you used the bar mitzvah money gift that you got to subscribe to Variety. Why did you want to read Variety?
I wish I'd never said that to anybody. I don't know. I think I was growing up in Potomac, Maryland. It was such an exotic world to me. The whole idea of show business and Hollywood. And I think that I knew that it was what I wanted to do and what I wanted to pursue. And I think the notion of seeing Variety gave me the sense that it was tangible and real, that in fact there were people out there doing that, and that it wasn't just sort of like a dream, which just really had no sense of reality in the world that I was in. I don't think I was, like, you know, going over the grosses, but I think there was something that was, you know, that made the world tangible and was exciting and exotic.
Which parts did you like to read most then?
You know, to be quite honest, I think one thing I really loved about getting Variety was that at the time they would have movie posters in there that you could pull out, and I'd put them up on my wall. So that's the one thing I remember looking forward to, is what kind of movie posters would they have in Variety this week that I could put on my wall. And it was a sense of, wow, I'd see what movies were coming out, and, you know, what was, I don't think I really sat there and you know, read the articles so much, but it by osmosis gave me a sense of the business, I guess.
Do you still subscribe to Variety?
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. I think everybody out there reads Variety.
And do you have to follow the grosses now?
You know what? I think it becomes habitual. And now the whole world follows the grosses. I mean, there was nothing that I was reading in Variety then that isn't now reported in every paper every Monday. I mean, you know, I think that kind of entertainment reporting has just become part of our national consciousness. And at that time, you know, over 20 years ago, didn't exist. There was no sense. Nobody cared how much a movie made over the weekend. And now suddenly everybody does.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Darren Star created the HBO series Sex and the City based on the book by Candace Bushnell. The fourth season begins Sunday. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Division, publisher of Bones of the Master, A Journey to Secret Mongolia, a travel memoir by George Crane, in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet Broadway music director Paul Gemignani. He's worked on most of Stephen Sondheim's musicals. At the Tony Awards ceremony this Sunday, Gemignani will receive a Lifetime Achievement Award. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by Destiny's Child. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Destiny's Child has spearheaded a revival of girl group rhythm and blues pop music, scoring big hits even as the group has undergone nearly constant personnel changes. The current version of the trio has a new album called Survivor, and rock critic Ken Tucker has some thoughts about the group and its album concept.
Question, tell me what you think about me. I buy my own diamonds and I buy my own rings. Only ring your celly when I'm feeling lonely. When it's all over, please get up and leave. Question, tell me how you feel about this. Try to control me, boy, you get dismissed. Pay my own condo and I pay my own bills. Always 50-50 in relationships.
The cultural critic Greil Marcus wrote an essay in 1979 saying that the term survivor, once a serious description of someone who had undergone extreme suffering, had become a cant word, applied, he wrote, to anyone who has persevered or rather continued any form of activity, including breathing, for almost any amount of time. Marcus compiled a large list of its usage in pop music, including the Rolling Stones' Soul Survivor, Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive, Lynyrd Skynyrd's Street Survivors, and the rock band called Survivor. More than 20 years on, we can add the TV phenomenon called Survivor, which, since it's a gaudy game show, fits to an absolute T Marcus's description of the debasement of the word as being, quote, severed from authentic contexts of will and endurance. And now we come to Destiny's Child and their new CD called Survivor. On the cover of Rolling Stone, the three members of Destiny's Child wear skimpy outfits made of army camouflage to denote their survivor status. And exactly what have they survived? Well, read any profile of the group and you find that they survived losing during an appearance of the old Ed McMahon show Star Search when the group's leader, Beyoncé Knowles, was a pre-adolescent. And Destiny's Child has survived numerous personnel changes over the past couple of years. The one constant has remained Beyoncé Knowles, the 19-year-old vocalist who on Survivor has taken over a lot of the songwriting and production chores. Much of her work is cleverly constructed, such as the crying on the inside, positive thinking pop song, Happy Face. Destiny's Child's proclamations of independence and equality have been evident from the start. When they were working with male producers, such as hitmakers Wyclef Jean, Rodney Jerkins, and Jermaine Dupri, they were releasing irresistible songs like the hymn to fidelity called Say My Name, and Bills, 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 which insisted that the men in their lives have sufficient employment to pay the aforementioned items. If they don't quite earn their CD's title, they've still proven that they know how to make music that'll help them survive the teen pop trend for at least another year or two.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly.
Is
Coming up, Broadway music director Paul Gemignani. He'll receive a Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement on Sunday. This is Fresh Air. At the Tony Awards this Sunday, my guest Paul Gemignani will be given a Lifetime Achievement Award. Broadway audiences don't get to see much of him because he's usually in the pit conducting the orchestra. Gemignani is a music director who has worked with Stephen Sondheim since 1973 on such musicals as A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Pacific Overtures, Sunday in the Park with George, Merrily We Roll Along, and Passion. Gemignani was also the music director for the revival of Brigadoon, the hit Crazy for You, and several operas. He's currently with the revival of Kiss Me, Kate. As the music director, he helps cast the performers and hire the orchestra. He rehearses the musicians and singers and is the liaison between the composer and the rest of the company. During performances, he conducts the musicians and singers. Gemignani says he particularly enjoyed serving as music director on Sondheim's Sweeney Todd. Here's the opening.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. His skin was pale and his eye was odd. He shaved the faces of gentlemen who never thereafter were heard of again. He trod a path that few have trod, did Sweeney Todd, a demon barber of Fleet Street. He kept a shop in London town of fancy clients and good renown. What if none of their souls were saved? They went to their maker impeccably shaved. By Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
In Sweeney Todd, I think the first that sound we hear is that steam whistle, a really discordant, shrill, alarming steam whistle that certainly sets the tone for, you know, a musical that's about very alarming thoughts and feelings and actions, including murder and revenge.
Right.
Did you actually have a steam whistle in the orchestra?
What happened was, it said in the opening thing on the top, it said whistle. Factory whistles is what it said. So we sat down and had discussions about what a factory whistle was, and I said, well, you mean the kind that has, like, thing that popped into my mind is those old English factory movies, or you know, like Dirk Bogart movies, where he's in a blue-collar section of somewhere in Britain, and his father works in the mines or in the factory, and on the top of that factory is this whistle that's actually made work from steam, right? Pretty shrill sounding. Yes, so I searched down. We finally found this actual factory whistle, and we hooked it up to a CO2 canister, and that's how we operated it. I operated it, actually, from a switch in the pit.
Huh.
And what they did was they put it in several places, but it was so intense that they had to keep moving it further away because the audience would, you know, like leap out of their seats. So we ended up putting it way up at the top. I don't know what you ever saw or pictures of the original production in New York, but
I saw the roadshow in Philadelphia.
Okay, well, the only difference between the roadshow and the one in New York is that Eugene Lee, the set designer, actually found a foundry roof somewhere in Vermont and had the thing, a foundry that was falling down, but the entire glass roof was, smoky glass roof with broken panes in it, was still intact. So they moved that entire thing to New York and put it up, erected it in the Uris, or the whatever you call it today, Gershwin Theater. And it was hanging over the orchestra pit. It went all the way to the back of the stage and hung over the orchestra pit and about 10 rows into the audience, over your head. So what we did is we put that whistle way up high. What we did on the road is we just put it up in the flies somewhere. And it was there for exactly what you said it was there for, shock value, and to start a musical about revenge.
Where did you find the factory whistle?
I didn't. The sound man did. I went to the sound designer and I said, I need a factory whistle. And he said, you mean the kind that I said, no, I mean the steam kind that go on the top of a building. He said, well, where am I going to find that? I said, oh, no, that's your job. So he did. He brought several back. And actually what we did in rehearsal, I remember the first day that he brought that in and we hooked it up to a CO2 canister in the front of the stage. And I said, well, Charlie said, you want me to play this? And he said, well, how loud is it? I said, I have no idea. I've never heard it. And said, well, let's play it. And I played it. It's like we almost all passed out from the sound. but it did what it was supposed to do.
I'm assuming that when you're conducting in a show that you have the whole score in front of you and the whole libretto in front of you, that you know you have in front of you all the lines that are going to be said.
It's in my head. I memorize like the actors do.
So you don't even have that in front of you? You know it that
well? No. I don't know why I do that, but I've always done it. So it's a lot easier. It's a lot more allows me to be more involved with the performance if I don't have to stare down at music. Of course, you know, if it's a concert or if it's something I just got, absolutely, I read whatever it is. Most of the time, I memorize the lines very quickly in my head because you do have rehearsals, and they go in my head that way. It's not something I actually make an effort to do, it just does it. So I would say that by the end of the first week of previews, most of the shows I've done, I've already have in my head memorized.
So have you ever been called on to fill in for an actor?
No. I won't be either. Now, apparently you've never seen me act.
What are some of the ways that you can help out a performer during the show?
I think the biggest way is to be attentive. I mean, you know, we're talking about highly trained professionals, and the level of mistakes or errors or misjudgments are really rare. In fact, most of the time, what will happen is the set will mess up way before any of us will mess up. But I think being totally attentive to their performance and being there, even if they don't need you every second, is the biggest support system you can give a performer, and that's what I try and do. I mean, if you notice, James Levine at the Met isn't staring down at the music very much. He's looking up at the stage, and that's what the theater's about. If you're a conductor and you're looking at the music, you're restricting yourself, and you're restricting the effect that you can have on the performance.
Do you ever help out with a forgotten line?
I have from time to time. Doesn't happen very often, but.
What do you do? Do you whisper it or just mouth it?
No, I just say it out loud. Because in those moments, half the time the audience would not even hear me say it, even though I say it out loud. But you say it out loud so the actor can hear it. And, hope that, and most of the time, people who go to the live theater expect anything, so they like all that involvement. But if an actor is really stuck, and you know the line, then I see no reason why you shouldn't say it, you know? So it doesn't happen very often, however, but it has happened.
Paul Gemignani is my guest, and he's getting a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Tonys. He's been music director for just about all of Stephen Sondheim's musicals, and he's currently music director on Broadway for Kiss Me, Kate. Was it your ambition as a kid to work in Broadway shows?
No. My ambition as a kid, my mother wanted me to be a classical musician, which I tried that for a while. But actually, I ended up being a drummer. When I was in high school, I was in the string section in the orchestra, and all my friends were in the band. So I tried playing tuba for a while. Didn't like that very much. Too heavy to carry around. And one of my friends talked me into percussion, which has to be there, but you don't have to carry it there, which appealed to me at the time, being a really lazy high school person. But I made a lot of money playing drums. I played in nightclubs in San Francisco, and I played around the country, and I could conduct, which I always wanted to do, always. I didn't know what I wanted to do with it, but I knew that that was something I wanted to do. So I used to conduct to records in my room when I was a kid.
You had worked with Harold Prince and Stephen Sondheim, from the start of your career as a music director, through the time that Sondheim and Harold Prince split up in the early 80s after the box office failure of Merrily We Roll Along. What did it mean for you when Sondheim and Hal Prince split up?
I had to choose. It wasn't an easy choice. I have a great deal of respect for both men. I love both men. They gave me my career, so it was not an easy choice to make. But I went with Steve because of the musical connection and how connected I feel to Steve's material and work. And, you don't meet many people in your life that artistically you feel connected with, or you feel like you're supposed to be there and you're supposed to be doing what you're doing with this person. Steve is one of those people for me. He's the person for me in that respect when it comes to music.
Can you explain why, what it is about his music?
I have no clue. Mm-hmm. I can tell you what I feel, but I can't tell you why. I don't know why. All I know is our relationship musically is built on the fact that for some reason unknown to me, I totally understand his music. I totally understand what his intentions are. I've never had to question it. I don't have to ask him a lot of questions. It's always been that way from day one. And in fact, now when we do a show together, he rarely shows up because he trusts me, which is very flattering. But, I have to say to him, you got to come because maybe I'm doing something you're not going to like. You got to come and see this.
My guest is Broadway music director Paul Gemignani. On Sunday, he'll receive a Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is music director Paul Gemignani, and he's been music director on most of Stephen Sondheim's musicals, including Sunday in the Park with George. And this year he gets the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Tonys. Can you think of a moment in a musical that you conducted where every night you'd say to yourself, this is what it's about for me. This is the kind of musical feeling, the kind of Broadway feeling that I live for?
I have to say Sunday in the Park. I have to say when Mandy and Bernadette sing We Do Not Belong Together, that's a moment that popped into my mind when you asked me that question. I'm sure there's a thousand others, but, working the 12 years I worked with Steve and Hal, I don't have to work anymore after that. I mean, all the thrill and all the expectations I had as an artist were fulfilled in that 12 years. Am I tired of working now? No. And will I continue until I can't work anymore? Absolutely. I'm just saying that you know, I feel kind of greedy at this point because I've had such great experience and great times in the past and had an opportunity to do so much artistically because of those two guys that, you know, everything else is gravy. But that one place in Sunday in the Park sticks in my mind.
Let's listen to that duet between Mandy Patinkin and Bernadette Peters from Sunday in the Park with George.
Yes, George, run to your work. Hide behind your painting. I've come to tell you I'm leaving because I thought you might care. You know, foolish of me, because you care about nothing.
I care about many things.
Things. Not people.
People, too. I cannot divide my feelings up as neatly as you. And I am not hiding behind my canvas. I am living in it.
But you care for it yourself.
I care for this painting. You will be in this painting.
I have something you can use.
I had thought you were destroyed.
Because I understand that I left that.
And
I am
there's
leaving.
Nothing I can say, is there?
Yes, George, there is. You could tell me not to go. Say it to me. Tell me not to go. Tell me that you're hurt. Tell me you're relieved. Tell me that you're bored. Anything. But don't assume I know. Tell me what you feel.
What I feel? You know exactly how I feel. Why do you insist you must hear the words when you know I cannot give you words? Not the ones you need. There's nothing to say. I cannot be what you want.
What do you want,
George? I needed you and you left.
There was no room for me.
You will not accept who I am. I am what I do, which you knew, which you always knew, which I thought you were a part of.
No, you are complete, George. You are your own. We do not belong together. You are complete, George. You are the
That's We Do Not Belong Together from Sunday in the Park with George. Conducting that was one of music director Paul Gemignani's favorite Broadway experiences. I asked him to think of another.
The first thing that Sweeney sings in Sweeney Todd to his razors, that moment sticks in my mind.
Friends?
Friends, yeah.
This is the moment when the barber Sweeney Todd, who's been put in prison, is out of prison. He's seeking revenge against the judge who locked him up. And shouldn't have, and the judge is now planning to marry Sweeney's daughter. It's an ugly story. but finally, Sweeney's reunited with his razors, and he's going to use them not only to be a barber, but to take his revenge. And he sings this beautiful song about how he's reunited with his friends, but what he's really thinking about is revenge.
Right.
What's so wonderful about this moment for you, conducting it?
Well, the beauty of the music and the irony of the idea. You know, it gives you something to perform. It's not, you know, it's not 32 bars in 4/4 time. It's, you know, a beautiful melody in an intense dramatic moment that's taking the story from one place to another. That is the theater to me, musical or otherwise.
Well, Paul Gemignani, congratulations on your Tony. Will your part be televised, or are you getting one earlier in the day behind the scenes?
I have no idea. I have no idea what they're going to do. They haven't told me what the process is.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
Paul Gemignani is a Broadway music director. On Sunday, he'll receive a Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with My Friends from Sweeney Todd, the song the vengeful barber sings to his razors.
These are my friends. See how they gleam. how he smiles in the light, my friend, my faithful friend. Speak to me, friend. Whisper, I'll listen. I know you've been locked out of sight all these years. Like me, my friend. Well, I've come home to find you waiting. Home, and we're together, and we'll do wonders. Won't we? You there, my friend.
I'm your friend.
Come,
too,
let
Mr.
me
Tom.
Hold you.
If you only knew,
now,
Mr. Todd.
Todd, you're warm in my hand, my friend,
you come home.
My clever friend.
I always had a fondness for you, I did.
Rest now, my friend.
Never you fear,
soon
Mr.
I'll
Todd.
Unfold.
You can move in
soon
here, Mr. Todd.
Splendors you never have dreamed all your days. At last, my arm is complete again.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at SaabUSA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the California energy crisis. We talk with journalist Lowell Bergman. He's been investigating the crisis for the PBS series Frontline and the New York Times. Bergman is also the former 60 Minutes producer portrayed by Al Pacino in the film The Insider. Join us for the next Fresh Air.